This is the Publix Radio. You're listening to The Weekly Catch. I'm James Baumgartner in for Luis Hernandez. Rhode Island College recently announced it will cut 20 degree programs this fall, mostly in the humanities. We'll hear from a professor and student at RIC who say the cuts are short-sighted and were done with little input from faculty or students. And did the Rhode Island Department of Transportation miss the warning signs about the Washington Bridge? Our reporters talked with engineers who say that critical components deserved special attention years before the closure. Also, Newport Art Museum's latest show features a 28-foot-long painting of a plaid whale. All that and more on this episode of The Weekly Catch. Rhode Island College has announced its intention to suspend 20 degree programs as of this fall, including gender and women's studies, Latin American studies, and education and master's level degrees in art, early childhood education, and music. RIC President Jack Warner says the cuts were not done for financial reasons, but are designed to eliminate majors with low demand. Opponents of the abrupt cuts say that this decision unnecessarily limits student opportunities and was made with few chances for campus feedback. Here to talk more about it is Dr. Leslie Schuster, professor of history at Rhode Island College. We're also joined by Danielle Hurwitz, a gender studies major at Rhode Island College. Thanks for joining us.
Very glad to be here. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Leslie, what majors are being eliminated?
Well, there are 20 majors that are being eliminated, primarily in arts and sciences, gender and women's studies, global studies, art history major. And then there are some in the Feinstein School of Education, including technology education and some of the languages.
A question for both of you. What's your general response to these cuts? Leslie, let's start with you.
I have many responses. My first response is that this really limits the opportunities for Rhode Island College students and for Rhode Island students, period. I mean, students may not want to come in being a global studies major or a gender and women's studies major or an art history major, but they want to be in a place where those issues and concepts are being discussed, where there's a place for that to happen. Those programs should not be only for the elite institutions that can afford those. I think it's very narrow-minded. It sort of assumes that our students shouldn't have or don't have the opportunity to expand their knowledge about the world.
Danielle, how about you?
I think it's really disheartening to see. I know there are similar cuts happening at other colleges. These are just really important programs, not just for people majoring in them, but for other people taking them, taking those classes. It's important to have these available. You learn a lot about culture, about the way society works. It really opens people's minds in a lot of these. And like languages, for example, is about communication as much as it is learning about those cultures. And these just aren't things that we should be cutting. A student should have access to this education.
Leslie, you're the director of the Gender and Women's Studies program, which is being cut. What is RIC losing with the elimination of this program and some of the others like it?
Well, the major is being cut. The minors are being preserved. So there are students who are continuing in the minors. In fact, I've had a bump in the number of students who have registered in the minors recently. Employment data shows us that there are jobs for gender and women's studies majors. I think the other thing that we're losing is an opportunity for students to see the world through different perspectives. Many of these programs, or at least global studies, also teaches students the liberal arts, right? It's an interdisciplinary program that gives students a broad view of the world. And I think to eliminate them is just a huge mistake.
Danielle, you're a student in the gender studies program. What are your plans going forward now that this major is being cut?
Well, I'm a senior this year, so I will still be able to graduate under this major. But I don't think it's a consolation that I still get my degree. I've been hearing more people interested in it in like incoming students. And I just think it'd be really wonderful to have more people in those classes and more discussions.
Danielle, what do you feel you've gotten from the program?
It's hard to condense it. I really just feel like we've touched on so many subjects and I just have such a better understanding of so many things that I don't experience. So as much as it is called gender studies, we also look at issues with racism or ableism. And those aren't necessarily things that I've experienced, but it just teaches so much empathy and so much understanding that I just wouldn't get without these classes.
Danielle, do you think the campus community should have been involved in the discussions that led to these cuts?
I definitely think that they should have been. I think the decision wasn't representative of how the students feel. Once this decision got made, there was so much pushback and disagreement from the students, which maybe is why they didn't involve the students. But as we're the ones taking the classes and we're the ones at the school, we really should have been consulted.
Have you heard from other students? What are you hearing from other students about the cuts, both in the gender studies program and across RIC generally?
I'm hearing a lot of upset people who are already in the programs and wanting to see those programs grow, but also from incoming students who aren't sure if they get to study what they are coming to RIC to study anymore because it was such a sudden decision after they were already accepted. I think it's really upsetting for anyone involved already in the programs, people wanting to study them as upcoming students, people who want to add a double major.
Leslie, of the 20 majors that are being cut, some of them have had few or no degree completions in recent years. Does it make sense to offer these concentrations that so few students actually major in?
Yes, I think it does. I don't know that we should be valuing education based on how many students graduate, right? Gender and Women's Studies has had less than 11 graduates in the last few years. That's the number that pegged us for this review. But that doesn't mean it's not a valuable academic study, an academic discipline for students. The same with global studies. I mean, I don't want to leave that out. Global studies in this day and age, you would think that global studies is so critical to our students to understand what goes on and how to view other countries and other worlds and other cultures. So these decisions just seem very, very limiting. The decision to base it on numbers seems really inappropriate in higher ed.
Danielle, a rally was held at the State House last month to protest these program cuts. How'd that go?
I think it went well. We had a good number of students turn out, and we had some really great speeches, but it also drew a lot of attention. So I think it really helped spread the news and get more people aware of what's going on.
Is there any way to save these programs at this point?
You know, I'm not sure. The administration has offered those of us with suspended programs the opportunity to respond, but those meetings are still in process. President Warner did indicate at one time that lists of programs that were identified for elimination would be sent to the chair of the Undergraduate Curriculum Committee, which has purview over curricula. That never happened. He also indicated at one point that faculty committees would have an opportunity to weigh in, and that never happened either. So right now, the Curriculum Committee is protesting because they argue that it is shared governance and their purview. And at the last meeting, the provost agreed that suspending enrollment needs to go through the Undergraduate Curriculum Council, which is puzzling to me. So honestly, I don't know. I really, really hope so.
Some opponents of these program cuts say it's part of a broader trend in higher education to cut liberal arts programs. Do you see it that way?
It's hard to see it any other way. There is a stress, unfortunately, on workforce programs, but all the data shows us that students who are educated broadly in liberal arts, in the humanities, have writing and thinking and critical analysis skills, and that is what the world needs.
I've been speaking with Dr. Leslie Schuster, professor of history at Rhode Island College, and Danielle Hurwitz, a gender studies major at Rhode Island College. Professor Schuster, Danielle, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so very much.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more from The Weekly Catch after this break. This is The Public Radio. I'm James Baumgartner, in for Luis Hernandez, and you're listening to The Weekly Catch. Our political reporter, Ian Donis, joins me now to break down the week in Rhode Island politics. Ian, welcome.
Hey there, James.
All right, so efforts to update Rhode Island's open records law have run into opposition. Is the outlook any better this year?
It's hard to say. The bureaucracy of government doesn't like being asked to do more. There are more exceptions that have been carved out over time, and it seems like the governor's office has not really been supportive of this. But advocates are making the case that open records are in the interest of the public. They're trying to broaden their coalition, and it's a good argument to make. This is the public's information, after all, so we will see how that plays out.
All right. So speaking of the General Assembly, advocates have been trying for more than a decade to cap the interest rate charged by payday lenders. Has the change in Senate leadership affected that?
Yes. The change in Senate leadership at least creates the possibility of something happening this year, with Val Lawson, now serving as Senate president, taking the seat formerly held by the late Dominic Ruggiero. For whatever reason, Ruggiero seems staunchly opposed to making any changes to cap payday lending. When I asked him about this late in the 2021 session, he told me he wasn't even aware that a bill had been filed. So that just showed how disinterested he was in making a change. People on the other side of the issue will say that payday lenders provide an important service, but critics say the interest they charge can go up to an annual percentage rate of 260%. That is vastly more than is legal for commercial lenders in Rhode Island, so it's an issue that bears watching.
And finally, the State Ethics Commission ruled this week that the number two official in the Senate, Majority Leader Frank Chacon, can vote on a gun bill, even though he holds a federal firearms license. What was the commission's reasoning?
The commission cited the class exemption. Chacon is one of 99 holders of a federal firearms license in Rhode Island, and the thinking was that he would be affected no more or no less than any of those other 98 license holders. That might not pass muster with some people, but the class exception has been used in a lot of cases to give lawmakers an out for voting on something. And Chacon is a conservative gun rights supporter. The president of the Senate, Val Lawson, is a more liberal person, perhaps more open to a new gun ban on new sales of assault-style weapons. So that bears watching in the closing weeks of the legislature.
All right. Thanks for the updates, Ian.
Thank you, James.
For more politics news, you can listen to the latest episode of Political Roundtable, available now at thepublicsradio.org. A year and a half after the closure of the westbound Washington Bridge, many of us are still wondering, how could a bridge go from handling tens of thousands of vehicles every day to suddenly being shut down and then permanently closed? Did the Rhode Island Department of Transportation miss warning signs that could have averted a possible disaster? These are questions we've heard from many of you as part of Breaking Point, our ongoing project about the bridge. Rhode Island PBS reporter Michelle San Miguel and the Public's Radio Senior Editor of Investigations Jeremy Bernfeld spoke with engineers about why critical components deserved special attention years before the closure and may have never received those crucial checks. They join me now. Michelle, Jeremy, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michelle, public officials have called this an unavoidable problem, but your investigation contradicts this narrative. What did you hear from the engineers that you spoke with?
James, I think it's important to start out by saying we have heard time and time again how this bridge has a unique design. And so with that in mind, it's important to note that many problems with this bridge relate to what's called the post-tensioning system. Simply put, it involves steel cables called tendons that are run through ducts in concrete. Now, the engineers who we spoke with say the issue is you can't look inside these ducts to see what's going on, right? Visually, they cannot be inspected. And the problem is that gaps within the ducts can allow water, road salt that's applied during cold weather, to corrode steel components. So you need other technologies to verify, essentially, that you have a good seal to make sure that water does not get inside. The engineers who Jeremy and I spoke with said RIDOT could have been monitoring these components for years using what's called special inspection methods. This is David Latanzi. He's an associate professor of civil engineering at George Mason University.
That means that you're going to watch this thing and you're going to use more advanced technologies and you're going to increase the frequency of the inspections as a result as well.
Latanzi and others point to bridge inspection technologies that essentially they operate like an X-ray, right? So they would offer an internal scan of bridge components that would allow you to detect issues like bad grouting, pockets of moisture. That's known as what's called a non-destructive evaluation, or NDE. We also spoke with an engineer named Dana Tawil. She's a structural engineer in Canada, also a PhD student at the University of Ottawa who's focused on corrosion in concrete bridges. And we asked her, when should bridge owners, like RIDOT, conduct these non-destructive evaluations?
Once there are signs of damage, for example, cracks, spalling, so that's when the concrete, you know, pieces fall off, it's an alarm. That's, you know, it's telling us, okay, the next step should be done, which is the non-destructive tests.
Jeremy, you submitted multiple public records requests about RIDOT's bridge inspections. What did you find?
So we asked RIDOT for a list of the special inspections that they have done on the bridge since 2014. And none of the reports that they shared with us included these non-destructive evaluation techniques. We also asked for the procedures for special inspections on the Washington Bridge, and they didn't send us any. They just sent us the inspection manual for bridges. It's 300 pages here in Rhode Island. We also asked for contracts that would spell out whether they hired anyone to do this kind of monitoring. What they sent us were contracts for work done after they actually closed the bridge. So we looked through all that. We spent a lot of time looking at these inspection reports from 2015 on, and we did find numerous examples of the kind of cracks and concrete spalling on piers that connect to this PT, post-tensioning system. We didn't find any of these NDE techniques.
You also found that before the bridge closure, there was 20 years of documentation showing that other bridges like this around the country were having these kinds of issues. Could RIDOT have learned from those examples to prevent that sudden closure?
Well, I think that's a good question. The engineers we spoke with and some of the research reports that we found that were, you know, publicly available and talked about within engineering circles, they point to the fact that corrosion in these post-tensioning tendons, it's a known issue. Now, it's not that these bridges are ineffective. It's not that these bridges are falling down all over the place. They are known as being very effective. But corrosion in the post-tensioning tendons is a thing that happens in these bridges. We found a report from the Federal Highway Administration that chronicles these problems in bridges across the country starting in 1999. Florida has had a number of these issues. I think part of the issue is it's a marine environment. There's lots of salt in the air. There's lots of moisture and water, you know, coming from the sky, coming from the ocean. So Florida has seen a number of examples of problematic tendons, corroding tendons in these post-tension systems. But there have been other examples kind of up and down the East Coast through into Minnesota. There have been examples in Europe. We found examples dating back decades of problems of corrosion in these post-tension tendons.
Michelle, what did public officials have to say in response to your reporting?
We asked RIDOT for an interview with Director Peter Alviti, but a spokesman declined our request, citing the ongoing lawsuit that the state filed last year against 13 companies that did work related to the bridge. So we proceeded to send a list of questions to the spokesman, including we asked the department if they were aware of tendon failures in post-tension bridges across the country, which Jeremy alluded to. A spokesman again declined to comment because of the lawsuit. We asked specifically if they've engaged in any of these non-destructive evaluations for the bridge. Again, they declined to comment. We even asked what was the lifespan of the bridge, and they would not answer that because of the lawsuit. And on that note, I think it's important to stress they had begun doing rehabilitation work on the bridge starting in October of 2021. Between that time and when the bridge was shut down in December of 2023, the state had already spent $34.5 million rehabilitating the bridge, right? Which begs the question, was that a wise use of taxpayer money?
Jeremy, what's the key takeaway here? What do you want people to come away with?
One, the idea that some of the problems that ultimately led to the shutdown of the bridge, they were known issues in this kind of bridge. And there were examples that perhaps we could have learned from. Also, there appeared to be testing that RIDOT could have engaged in to get a better look at the health of the bridge. It may not have been something that they could have completely solved, but it's also possible that they could have had better planning. They could have done some repair work. It could have lengthened this process so it wasn't this kind of imminent crisis. And third, we asked RIDOT a number of questions. They're still outstanding. RIDOT wouldn't speak to us for this story. They did not provide us a lot of information. And so we're still looking for transparency around this issue.
I've been speaking with Rhode Island PBS Weekly reporter Michelle San Miguel and the Publix Radio Senior Editor of Investigations, Jeremy Bernfeld. Michelle, Jeremy, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having us.
Great to be here.
And you can watch their full report on the warning signs about the Washington Bridge this Sunday at 7:30 p.m. on Rhode Island PBS Weekly, also available on YouTube. We'll be back with more from The Weekly Catch after this break. This is The Weekly Catch. I'm James Baumgartner, in for Luis Hernandez. And it's time for Artscape. The Newport Art Museum has a show called Sean Landers, Lost at Sea. It features some of the nautical-themed work of painter Sean Landers. As you approach the gallery, you first pass through a hallway lined with etchings by Winslow Homer. The prints are from the Newport Art Museum's permanent collection, but they were selected by Sean Landers to accompany the paintings.
When I first started to want to learn to paint water, I looked toward Winslow Homer to sort of teach me how to do it. I looked at books of his paintings, and I went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York and looked at what they had there. And whenever I'd be visiting a New England art museum, I would sort of keep my eye out for a Homer.
The etchings show various aspects of life on or around the ocean. They were published in Harper's Weekly from the 1850s through the 70s. One etching is called Dad's Coming. Here's Newport Art Museum Exhibitions and Collections Manager Jeff Foy.
You know, this is a young child sitting on a rowboat and a mother holding, presumably, that child's younger sibling. You know, this is a very common moment from life, but the composition is elegant. There's a stability, the seas are calm. You know, there's an elegance, or like a, you know, this is a nice moment.
Once you walk past the etchings, you'll enter the gallery and see a gigantic painting of a whale on the opposite wall. It's 9.5 feet tall and 28 feet long. The whale's underwater, but near the surface, with its tail stretched up just touching the surface. The whale is covered in a plaid pattern, worn down in some places, completely torn in others. Sean says the plaid is a reference to the work of surrealist painter René Magritte.
For one year of his life, he made really atypical paintings. They're loose and crude. And he was at that time kind of recognized all over the world as the leading surrealist, but André Breton and the crew in Paris didn't accept him at the time. So he kind of wanted to ridicule them. And so he made these slapdash paintings, which I think are fantastic.
One of those paintings from 1948 is called L'Estropiat, and it depicts a man with three noses, each covered in plaid.
So it's easy to see the jump from plaid noses to a big plaid whale nose, you know. But the plaid also began to signify for me a year of artistic freedom in this. An artist who was already, I think, very free, but he even went further. And the plaid began to symbolize for me to keep it loose and free and don't be afraid to change and follow your heart, which is where always the best art is made for all artists.
It's a dark scene, underwater with only a little light getting through. It's somber, but the plaid relieves some of that somberness until you get a little closer and notice all the harpoons stuck in the back half of the whale. Of course, the piece also draws inspiration from the Herman Melville novel.
What is my white whale? Well, it's making art that they hope will survive time and go on without me. So the harpoons began to symbolize every sort of painting I make is an effort to make a lasting work that will survive. And the question is, will it? In Moby Dick, the whale wins and the boat goes down. I hope my fate's better.
The gallery has a few of Sean Landers' other paintings with maritime themes. There's a couple lighthouses, whale skeletons washed up on the shore, and two underwater scenes on the ocean floor that each show a shipwreck in the distance. And in the foreground, there's a stone with an inscription. Jeff Foy from the Newport Art Museum read one for me.
Is there any beating death? Is art humanity's best answer to death? No art will truly last forever. So is all art just another broken harpoon in the back of an uncaring monster? What's great about this exhibition is that it has layers where it can be just, I'm enjoying this painting of a lighthouse, which is something I already know that I like. I like lighthouses. These are terrific lighthouse paintings. I like whales. It's a terrific whale painting. But there's also issues of creativity. There's issues of the artist's personal psychology. There's a lot of layers should you choose to spend some time and really engage with the paintings. They're very rewarding.
Sean Lander's Lost at Sea is on display at the Newport Art Museum through the end of the year. Artscape editor Mareva Lindo joins me now to share a few tips on what to do this week. Mareva, what's going on?
Well, I want to briefly talk about the other part of Artscape this week, which looks at Newport 1775, Whose Side Are You On? At the Newport Historical Society. This exhibition takes you back to the streets of Newport during the American Revolution, when loyalists and patriots lived alongside each other. At the end of the exhibit, you will decide whether you would be a loyalist or a patriot, a choice that's a little bit more complex than you might think. You can see Newport 1775, Whose Side Are You On? At the Newport Historical Society now through December. Also, the RISD grad show is on right now through May 29th. The annual event features work by this year's graduating class of advanced degree candidates, including things like ceramics, photography, and illustration, but also things like industrial design and architecture, all side by side. That's on now through May 29th at the Rhode Island Convention Center in Providence. And if you're listening to this on Friday, you still have two more chances to see the complete works of William Shakespeare abridged, revised again, at the Contemporary Theater Company in Wakefield. It's just rapid-fire Shakespeare for 97 minutes with lots of silliness performed by just three actors. And it really does include bits from all his major works. The final performances are today and Saturday at 7 p.m. at the Contemporary Theater Company in Wakefield.
All right. Sounds like fun. Thanks, Mareva.
Thanks, James.
That's it for our show. The Weekly Catch is a production of The Public's Radio. Our producer this week is Joe Tasca. Our editor is Mareva Lindo. Our chief content officer is Sally Isley. And our president and CEO is Pam Johnston. I'm James Baumgartner in for Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening.